Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
Well, hello, and welcome to Chef Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we're broadcasting from the International Culinary Center in Soho, New York City. And I am very, very happy to say, and I love this, I'm welcoming today Mark Welker, the executive pastry chef at 11 Madison and Nomad, but he's also a graduate of this, and a very distinguished graduate of our International Culinary Center. So welcome, Mark.
Thank
welcome
you, Dorothy.
Home.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. And I think a lot of, you know, you're ranked number five in the world, aren't you, right now, on the
Yes.
top 50 restaurants in the world? And you are the executive pastry chef there. And I think you've been with 11 Madison and working with Daniel for quite a bit of time, since 2009?
Yes, 2009.
Right. So let's hear your journey, because you're not that old. And my God, to be working at your level is really quite something. And you're quite renowned for a number of your desserts. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in southern Indiana, in Seymour, Indiana.
The heartland.
The heartland, yeah.
Yeah, boy, good dessert. What desserts do you remember from there?
I mean, my family's not from Indiana. Like, Indiana people, you know, they're simple. But growing up, we would always be baking, and I remember the holidays a lot, cookies, homemade bread, gingerbread houses in the Christmas time, and just, you know, I mean, I grew up eating popsicles, running around, you know, the neighborhood with barefoot, and didn't really know what fancy food was or fine dining, or had no idea what else
was
out there.
So what happened? So what, like, so tell me, you know, when you were 8 years old, what did you want to grow up to be?
Probably a firefighter.
Really?
I have no idea what I wanted. Cooking didn't really come around until high school, and I think a lot of it came from the Food Network, and just realizing.
Who did you watch back then?
Back then it was like Ming Tsai and Emeril and Jacques Pepin, and, you know, there was a Great Chefs program that was on like PBS, I think. But I always cooked with my mom at home, you know. I was like always helping out. We'd have huge cookie decorating sessions during Christmas, homemade breads, and, you know, we'd always look forward to our gingerbread house that we do every year. And I've always just kind of been into it. And then realizing that you can make a profession out of it, and understanding my personality, that I didn't want to get stuck behind a desk or go to a 4 to 6 year university, that just didn't interest me. So I was really excited to understand that you can make something of your life with this.
So what did you do?
So I went to culinary school when I graduated. I went to, first off, in Louisville, Kentucky, went to Sullivan College. And there, just a good foundation in baking and pastry, but I started working with a chef named Anu Chariot, part of Chariot's restaurant that used to be there. And he really inspired me and taught me what it was to be a chef, and pushed me harder than I've ever been pushed before.
And when you say that, what is pushing like?
It's like, I wrestled in high school, and I guess you can kind of, you know, look at it the same way, but it's someone that constantly challenges you and makes you work harder and not accept things and always try to achieve better product and learning more, too. It's like going home and reading and the homework I mean, it was like an old school kitchen, you know? So like there's a little bit of fear involved.
Tell me a story, a fearful story. were the old days like?
So our walk-ins were downstairs, and the kind of the bakery was downstairs where all the pastries were made. But I remember one time a case of apples didn't get put away fast enough, and they got thrown down the stairs, and yelling happened.
Getting hit by them.
Not getting hit, but I mean, they definitely flew. I also remember a story. I was making ice cream and separating eggs, and I was getting a little too much egg whites into the bowl, and just the comments. So one day I'll show you how to separate an egg, you know. And it's like those comments really make you focus on the details on what you're doing. And he's right, you know. The chef, 90% of the time, he's right, or maybe even more. And And I wanted to be the best, you know, so those kind of things really hit me hard.
Really? Yes, sure. Well, so it really comes from within.
It does come from within.
It's that competitive perfection. What sign are you?
I'm a Leo.
You're a Leo. Okay. So the evidence is right there. So how did you progress from restaurant to restaurant?
So I stayed with him for about 3.5 years, and then I moved to St. Louis for a girl, but also just for bigger city, better opportunities and things. And there I went to a classic French restaurant, and I was doing the pastries plus garmager and making terrines and doing all the charcuterie, which is very similar to pastry, and I caught on to all that really well. And I started working for Larry Forgione after that with an American place, and there was extreme farm to table and like really understanding ingredients and seasons, and I was fascinated by it, but I quickly grew out of St. Louis. There wasn't enough there to challenge me, and I felt like my life getting a little more comfortable, and being comfortable made me nervous and made me feel like I was settling for less than what I was capable of doing. And a huge part also, I really wanted to work in Europe. I wanted to go to France, where in my mind I've never been, but you know, you read the books, you hear the stories, and that's where pastry kind of started and was truly refined. So I started saving money. And I decided to take a detour when I left St. Louis and come here to the FCI. So I moved to New York. I enrolled in the FCI then for their bread program. And then I stayed in New York a little bit after that, just working a
seasonal job.
Was
that Chef Hans when you were here? Chef Hans?
No.
It was Johnson?
It was Johnson. No, yeah. Johnson was the PM. It was Roger and
Oh, Roger.
And
oh,
from Amy?
And Amy, yeah. Roger Garrell,
yeah.
From Bouchon Bakery.
Yeah.
Oh, those were the good days, yeah. And still, they're still good days. The Johnson's up there, but
So
great.
That was exciting.
Yeah.
And then I found a bakery in France that would take me. So I moved to France.
Where
for
was
nine
that?
Months. It was in Béziers, in the south of France.
And how did you find it?
It was through Eric here at the
ICC. School.
Yeah. He helped me out, and so I moved to France.
Wow. Did you speak French?
I started taking private lessons, and I was very nervous about it because you don't speak French here in America, so there wasn't much practice.
<It's> for sure.
But three, four months in, I started to feel pretty confident, and I wasn't crossing the street when I saw someone approaching me at that point.
So tell me about the state of pastry. You know, I think 30 years ago when I started the school, French pastry was it. You know, you had Mitschlag with German, a good German pastries, but and Viennese, but the French, as far as refined and pushing the envelope, was it. Was there something special in France, or was that just one aspect of it?
I think it was just a goal. It was a goal of mine that I had to accomplish in order for me to be successful, settling down in a place and really committing myself to another place. And I was getting older, and I was like, you know, I need to make this a career and not just jump around. And that was a personal goal of mine that I had to reach. And what I learned most in France, I thought it was going to be like this huge mind-opening experience. But then you open a tub of glucose and all these things, it's the same exact ingredients that we're using here. And they're using the same techniques that I already knew here. It's just culturally, you're able to do a lot more of it, you know, and people love the pastries there, and they love Viennoiserie, and they go there in the mornings, they come after school, they, you know, the bakery's kind of shut down for a small time, then we reopen, and everyone's coming to pick up hors d'oeuvres and small cakes to take to dinner parties and everything like that. So it was super exciting to be in that culture where pastry and being a pastry chef was celebrated, you know. Mm.
So we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to hear a bit more about your journey.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and today my guest is our graduate, Mark Welker, who is the executive pastry chef at 11 Madison and Nomad. So your French journey, do you recommend it to aspiring young chefs?
If that is a personal goal of yours, then yes, I recommend doing it. What I see now is a lot of younger chefs stopping their career too short, in my opinion, to go travel and to do all these things. And I don't see it all the time being beneficial for their career.
So you mean they're not spending enough time in the kitchen, and what they're saying is, I'm going to go to X, Y, or Z country and check out what they're doing.
Yes.
And then, uh-huh. And where are they going today?
I just have South America, you name it, Australia, Europe, Iceland, Sweden. They just want to go. They want to stage. They want to travel. They want to see where food comes from. But it's important to them, and I don't think that they're obviously not happy doing what they're doing now unless they do that. And that was kind of the same situation to me. Do I think that going to France is going to make you a better pastry chef? No. I think that here in America we have all the resources, if not more, to become successful and to learn everything that you need to know to become a successful pastry chef.
So in your mind, what is the perfect amount of staging, and where? How long should you be in a kitchen and before you move on? And
I would minimum 18 months to 2 years. I don't think that you can fully understand. And it's got to be the right kitchen. You know, there's some bad environments out there and standards that are not very good. You know, cleanliness, organization, and having the right chefs in the kitchen to actually mentor younger people who want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
There's too much of like a party environment in a lot of these smaller restaurants, and just the going out and everything like that. And it just... that's all fun, but, you know, you're there to focus.
Afterwards or during service?
You see some places where, they drink during service, and it's just not a healthy environment. So I would definitely recommend staying away from those. And, you know, culinary school, like right off the bat, that's just like so much more, you know, secondary education. Like, you think like the more you go and the higher up you go, it's like I still consider myself, I'm like getting my PhD right now, you know, like.
Well, you know, in Europe, they used to have the apprenticeship system.
Yes.
And when you were an apprentice, you were just learning the basics. And then you became a journeyman.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, an apprenticeship would last maybe 2 or 3 years. And then journeyman would last 10 or 15 years. And then maybe you got to be master.
Yes.
And I think school, in my mind, replaces the apprenticeship, where
yes.
you just learn your basic things. But then you have to become a journeyman. You can never really reach a master level unless you've worked on a lot of different, under different people and seen what they've done and really get the nuance of the industry. So tell me about your kitchen. How did you get to 11 Madison? How did you work with Daniel, tell me what the kitchen is like. Let's open the door there.
So when I came back to the States from France, I came to New York, and I was kind of tired of being in France. I wanted to learn some more techniques and stuff. So I came back, and I was doing a stage at WD-50. And that was great and all, and it lasted about a month and a half. And then the economy was tanking at this point. It was 2008, and I hadn't seen my family in about a year. But there weren't any jobs that I wanted available. People just weren't hiring pastry chefs, and I didn't know what I wanted. So I went back home, saw my family, and then I went back to St. Louis and opened up a coffee shop with a couple friends.
Because of the pastry?
I was just helping. They're my best friends bought a coffee shop.
Oh, I see.
And they wanted some help, and I was available. So I went there and helped them, with the pastries, the breakfast program.
Must have been delicious having you come back from France and do the pastries.
I mean, it was coffee shop stuff, but we had a good time. And then I saw 11 Madison Park was hiring, and at that time it was USHG, which I was very familiar with those restaurants.
That's Union Square Hospitality Group,
yes,
the Danny Meyer Group.
And I just saw the pictures of the food, and it looked beautiful, and I was like, I want to be there, you know? So I applied, and I sent them an email, you know, and set up a stage. And I was like, well, I'd like to stage because I really want to work. I want to stage for 3 days so I can work the morning, kind of mid-shift, and see PM service and stuff like that. And I went there, and I just put my head down, hustled, and I got hired. So I started off as a cook.
Well, how was it hard to get into that kitchen? Do you think what on your resume made them accept you? How many people do you think were trying to get into that kitchen?
I don't know if too many were at that point in time. It was a 3-star restaurant. We were just, you know, another restaurant with USHG, and It wasn't as hard as it is now, you know.
Oh,
but even now though, like, we're always looking for good people, and cooks are becoming harder to find.
Yes.
Especially qualified ones that wanna work and wanna invest into the company.
That's right.
So I just kept my head down and I kept working, and within a year I was promoted to pastry sous chef.
Within a year?
Yes.
Wow. So tell me what that kitchen is like, and how is it different from other kitchens? Now, you've kind of told us on the poor end, you've got the party kitchens, and you know, not the
yes.
But your kitchen, I've been there. It's really something else.
It's very disciplined. You know, it's very quiet, and you're there to work. You keep your head down. You have your projects. You have chefs. Everyone's hustling, and there's a sense of urgency and. There's a level of quality. Everybody there wants to do their best, and they want the food to be perfect, and it has to be perfect. So it's stressful.
How do you maintain that discipline? And you're saying it's a quiet kitchen, so I'm taking it there's not a lot of yelling.
There is not a lot of yelling. No,
so how is the stress, you know, sort of imparted?
The fear of failing, the fear of having to redo something, you know, and just being set up for service and wanting to excel in what you're doing.
So it's almost personal.
A lot of it is personal.
Yeah.
I mean, and if you mess something up, the chef takes it personal. Like it offends us when somebody isn't respecting the dish or respecting the mise en place perfectly.
So I believe we're going to take another little break here. And when we come back, I'd like you to share with us how you conceive your desserts. And then how does it go from your head into production? And
yes.
And then how do you take these young cooks and discipline them? So we'll be right back.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you. Have you listened to A Taste of the Past? It's a show devoted to connecting our current food world with its storied past. Host and culinary historian Linda Palacio welcomes chefs, scientists, authors, scholars, and revolutionaries into the studio to discuss food culture and history from around the globe.
Have you seen the culture of food change over the past 25, 30 years?
Incredible. It's been incredible.
Linda covers content ranging from the history of black chefs in the White House to behavioral psychology and the evolution of Italian food in America. You can listen to A Taste of the Past anytime on heritageradionetwork.org or on iTunes and Stitcher.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and today my guest is Mark Welker, the executive pastry chef of Nomad and 11 Madison Park, one of the number five on the 50 best restaurants in the world San Pellegrino list. So, Mark, I asked you a question right before the break about how do you, you know, you when you were in the pastry shop in France and when you were working for these other chefs, you're in production mode.
Yes.
You're taking their ideas and executing, and you're perfecting your technique. What happens, and when does that transition happen when you become a chef where you get to create?
I think it's just a matter of time. You know, like if I moved on from 11 Madison Park and went to another restaurant, it would be very difficult for me to adapt to that restaurant style of food. I would always be kind of doing what I do right now. I've been working with Chef Daniel for so long now that I really understand his vision and the vision of the food. And for desserts, it needs to make sense with the cuisine, with the food that's being served at that restaurant. It doesn't make sense if you're serving like the style of food that we do at 11 Madison Park now, and then you got to the dessert course, and it was like these fancy chocolate deco pieces and, you know, more what you normally see at other restaurants. So it needs to feel, the flow needs to feel good through the entire meal. And we always talk about food, and we always ask ourselves, is like, is this delicious? You know, is it beautiful? Is there a creative element? You know, what story does it tell? And we always push ourselves to get
so
to
do
this
you,
point.
Do you have a personal, like, glass of wine with Daniel Hulme and say, okay, what's our new menu going to look like? And what are you going to do? And what are, and how collaborative is it?
It's very collaborative. There's no wine involved, but we do. We have research and development team. We have tastings every week. So every Wednesday, the entire sous chef team and chefs, we all put up food for the next menu. Right now, we're finishing up our spring menu, and we're already starting to conceive the summer menu and what that's going to be like. And
so you don't have the summer products yet. So.
We do not, but yeah. we conceptualize them, and then we'll source products from wherever. I mean, there's something in season somewhere. You know,
okay, so take me through one of your new spring desserts that you, from conception, how you thought about it, and then how you refined it, and how it'll get introduced.
So for spring, we're doing a strawberry dessert with elderflower, and it just... I mean, for me, like, I first start thinking of an ingredient that we can get our hands on and that's going to be good. And then I start breaking it down. How can we prepare this? Like, what are all the different techniques that we can do with strawberry and what's going to accompany it? And one of my favorite ways to use strawberries is to poach them. And so we work with poached strawberries and an elderflower syrup and just kind of, like, just get a feel for what the dish is going to look like. And you don't really know until you start putting things on a plate. And kind of like the more you plate your food, you got to plate it over and over and over before it goes up. Like chef, and he can tell too, if you put up a dish, he'll know right away. He's like, how many times have you plated this? Have you plated this before? Like it looks like crap, you know, because you know. And just the more that you work on it, you just get an idea of where it needs to go. So we're doing poached strawberries with angel
food
cake.
When you first start doing a dish, it changes over the course of it being on the
menu. Very much so. And then sometimes it doesn't go on the menu. You know, this dessert, we started off doing a dessert with buttermilk because we make our own butter. We make a cultured butter for bread service. And then we have all this buttermilk left over, and it's delicious. So we were trying to utilize buttermilk to make a dessert. And we're doing a panna cotta with buttermilk and strawberries and rhubarb and vinegar and all these different things. And we could just never make it feel like it worked with the food. And we worked on this dish for a long time, and then we scrapped it, you know? And it doesn't mean it's gone, because we document everything, we take photographs, and everything is still there. So we may pick it up for next year or 2 years from now. So we move in a different direction, and the direction that we move in, it feels better.
So where do you source your strawberries? Because I feel that strawberries are one of the most disappointing fruits, because it doesn't have that real strawberry flavor.
Yes.
So it must be, and they're so, like, these 2 weeks, the strawberry is good here, and those 2 weeks.
Yes.
So how do you, as a pastry chef, source
we,
that?
In the off-season, we use Harry's Berries, based out of Santa Barbara in California. They're already starting to be delicious from out there. And we always try to use local. So once the local ones come in season, if they're good and not too watery, we buy from the market, you know?
Union Square Market?
Yeah.
So you'll go there and shop in the morning?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have a purchaser, but like mm-hmm. when I go into work, like I get off at Union Square, you walk through, you taste, you finish your stroll to work, you think about what you just saw, and then you can sit down with our purchaser and kind of go over things.
Yeah, go back and buy it. Yeah.
Or we have a relationship with the farmer, so a lot of times they get our orders together and then we can go pick it up. Or there's different co-ops from upstate that can come and deliver to us.
How many people do you have working for you in the kitchen?
At 11 Madison Park, it's about 13 to 15 cooks and pastry. And at the Nomad, it can be a little bit more. It's about 15 to 17 pastry cooks.
That's a big pastry division. How many restaurants today have that big of pastry staff?
Not many. A lot of times it's just pastry chef and maybe an assistant in these
right.
smaller restaurants.
So why do your restaurants have that big a staff?
I mean, it's very important, I think, to the restaurant. It's important to chef that the pastry program is a big part
Excel.
Of the restaurant. And we make a lot of things for the restaurant, not just desserts. So desserts, you know, right now you go to the menu and you have the Eggs Benedict for the caviar service, and we make these little English muffins. You know, we know our covers there. We do 110 covers every night. Lunches, we can do 50. So it's about 1,000 people a week that we serve. You know that everybody gets two, so you need 2,000 of those, plus the ones that don't make the cut. You're talking 3,500 mini English muffins that we're producing every week. Bread service, if a new hors d'oeuvre or something comes on, private events, it's a lot.
30 people working for you.
Yes.
So how do they break down? You know, there's that traditional brigade of the kitchen, and you're the general.
I've seen it all between hives, anxiety attacks, crying in the office, you name it, you know, and you kind of get a feel, but sometimes you're surprised, and that's always awesome when you're like, I don't think this person's gonna make it, but we hire based off of personality. We want to hire good people, so we hire...
What do you look for?
A nice person, you know, and someone that wants to be a chef, and they understand the commitment that they're coming into, you know? But we want good people, and I'm not saying good technically because we can teach them that, but if you're a nice person, if you're the type of person that's walking down the street and someone drops something, you're going to pick it up and run after them to give it back to them. Those are the kind of people
we want
working.
Yeah.
Because you're surrounded by these people, and we're so big on creating a culture in our restaurants that feels like family, and we're there for so long, we work together, and people get stressed out, you know, and you want to be around people that aren't going to be annoyed by it and that understand and can work around it.
What's your biggest pet peeve of the people that you hire? What do you see that really just you think, oh, not again, or I'm so disappointed in this person?
I call it millennial fever. I think it's these younger chefs that are coming in, and they work for about a year or less than a year, and then they just quit, like 100%, like stop cooking, like they don't want to do this anymore, you know?
So they don't go to another restaurant, they just
stop. A
lot
of times they don't go to another restaurant, and that's my biggest pet peeve, because then you feel like you wasted your time. You feel
that's
like they
true.
Wasted, you have all this invested in them. I feel like a parent, and you're like, you're making a bad decision, and I'm not just saying that because I want you here. You know, I'll help you find another job at a restaurant if this isn't the right place for you, if it isn't a good fit, but... Don't quit, you know.
And it takes you probably as a chef about a year to get them to be as productive as you want them
True.
To be.
I mean, some people are quicker than others, but
yeah.
I'd say less than a year. I mean, a year is a long time, especially at 11 Madison Park. A year. After a year, people, if they don't see a foreseeable growth into a sous chef or with the company, they may move on. And we have a lot of visa people there, so a lot of J-1 visas, OPT visas.
Where are they coming from?
Different culinary schools. Right now at 11 Madison, we have people from Amsterdam, Italy, England, Ireland, you name it, France, all over the world.
Where do they live? New York is so hard to find a place to live.
Brooklyn, I don't know, Queens.
Brooklyn, like. Queens, yeah, I know.
Some of them live on 23rd and 2nd, you know.
Yeah. Lucky people.
Yeah.
So tell me, what are some of your favorite desserts that you've made in your life?
I think my favorite at the Nomad.
Famous. Okay. Do you want to describe it for everyone?
So it's almost like a cereal based on the bottom. It's dehydrated milk foam, honey brittle, honey oat shortbread, milk ice cream, and it's drizzled with buckwheat honey and fleur de sel.
That fleur de sel is what does it, you know? Wow.
And we finish all of our desserts with salt. Like, every single dessert has salt on it.
Why is that?
Because it seasons the food. Salt makes things taste better. And it needs to be balanced. Like, not too sweet. You need acidity. You want textures, creamy, crunchy, with a frozen, hot. But the salt really just brings it together. And we treat a lot of our desserts just like a chef treats a salad or a dish. And it's kind of that's just how we cook. It's our philosophy.
So I think I have this philosophy that every really successful person has been a huge failure at some point and was able to work through it. Have you had one of those moments?
A huge failure.
Or have you just been pretty lucky going up the ladder here?
I think I've been pretty lucky. I've been in some relationships that cooking has not worked out for them.
Yes, I've been
but
there.
But we all learn from it and move past it. But no, I think every decision that I've made has been really thought out and planned. I make goals for myself that I can attain. I reach those goals short term, long term. And that's, I want my cooks to do the same thing. And I think that sets you up for success. You know, I think people who fail have unrealistic goals that they're setting for themselves, and they don't really know themselves well enough to do something.
That could be. With the people that work for you, if you could say to your whole staff right now, this is the one thing I'd like you to improve on, what would it be?
One thing to improve on.
Across the board.
Across the board, probably be cleanliness.
Really?
Yes, being clean and organized.
How do you learn that?
Practice, doing it, being told to do it, looking, opening your eyes, you know. I think a lot of people, they work with blindfolds on, or, you know, they can't see around them. They're only focused on what's in front of them.
You know, when I first opened the school here, it was 1984, and I guess it was in the, like, 86, 87, I used to walk home. I lived in the Village, and I went down Varick Street, and there was a restaurant there called Raquel, and it was, the chef there was Thomas Keller, and it would be 11:30 at night, and I would go in, and I'd get a glass of wine, and Thomas would be on his knees washing the stoves, the inside of the stove, and he was the chef. And I remember asking him, I said, Thomas, why are you the one washing out the, you know, cleaning out the stove? And he said, because it's too important to leave it to the cooks. You know, wow. And that, I mean, that's Thomas.
But it's true.
Right? It is true.
If you're not working clean, if you have a dirty side towel, if your apron is dirty, you know, if things are messy and not properly lined, how is that going to translate to the food on the plate? There's no way that you can work dirty and then execute good food. And
is there anything that you would be if you were not a pastry chef?
If I were not a pastry chef, I'd probably want to be a photographer and travel.
Wow, that makes sense. You know, pastry is so visual.
Yes.
Yeah. Where would you travel?
Wherever. I've been really into Southeast Asia lately.
Oh, really?
I just got back from a trip to Vietnam, and there's always an adventure over there to see.
Right. So exotic.
It's very exotic.
Really exotic.
The food is delicious. The people.
So here you are at one of the greatest restaurants in the world. What's your future like? Your executive pastry chef. It's like, how much more top can you get than that? Do you still have challenges out there for yourself?
Of course, and the challenge is we're getting ready to open up Nomad in Los Angeles, and then we have a fine dining restaurant that we're going to open up in New York in 2018 called 425 Park. And that's what's on the horizon for me is you know, going to be managing those places, getting the pastry programs up and running, but just inspiring cooks to want to work for you is the challenge, and keeping and right now knowing these restaurants that we're going to open is inspiring people that want to invest into the company and really working with the good people that hopefully will be running one of those kitchens.
So help me get into the DNA of a chef of opening more restaurants. As you know, Andre Sultner is on the faculty here, mm-hmm. and he had one restaurant, Lutes. And I remember, I think it was Danny Meyer who went in with Audrey to have dinner once at Lutes. And Andre went up to him and said, oh, Danny, I'm so sorry. And Danny says, what? Why? Why, chef? Why? He goes, your restaurant closed, no? Why are you here? You know, he was the one who never thought you should leave your restaurant if it was open. And today we have, you know, people opening multiple restaurants, and of course they can't be there. So what is the desire when you have, you know, world-class restaurant in two locations going out to L.A.? Is it the commercial desire?
I mean, part of it is branding. you know, 11 Madison Park will never be recreated. You know, that is a New York restaurant and always will be. But the Nomad is something that we want people to experience. And, you know, in Nomad LA, you know, the architects are going to design it so it feels like you're in LA, you know, and the food will eventually evolve into that. And that's cool. That's exciting.
It's another creative outlet. So it isn't sort of a cookie cutter of New York Nomad.
No, it will not be. I mean, probably at first, like, but then the evolution, because out there you have the farmers markets are so much different here. The growing seasons are different. The seafood that you get. And we stay pretty local here in New York, you know, like if we have, you know, fin fish on our menu, we're using tile fish, we're using black bass. We're not using crazy Japanese fish or anything like that, because it's just not us. We feel like we can get it fresher if it's local. And out there, it's just going to be a whole different shopping.
Do you have an LA dessert spinning in your mind yet?
No, not yet. You have to compartmentalize all that stress, and that's coming. It's coming about a year from now. So,
so do you have time for hobbies?
Hobbies? I ride a motorcycle. That's probably my biggest activity that I do when it's nice out.
Daniel was wasn't he an Olympic cyclist?
I don't know if he was in the Olympics, but he was very competitive with it. And I think that was before he became a chef. And he still rides today. He runs. He was in the marathon. We actually have a running club at the restaurant. Yeah. They meet every morning or every Monday morning.
Wow. You know, it's hard to... Well, it's very physical in a restaurant,
yes.
Isn't it? And so then to run on top of that, one knows the knees are going to go. One of these. What do you like to do? When you go in a restaurant, what do you look for?
What do I look for?
When you're a customer.
When I'm a customer, I want to feel welcomed. I want to feel like I'm in someone else's house that is being hospitable to me. I want to feel relaxed. I want to be able to have a good time. And I think that's the most important thing. I think the hospitality side of restaurants is almost more important than the food. I'll go to a restaurant if the food is amazing, but the hospitality sucks, like I won't come back, you know? And there's a thin line where I'll kind of meet in the middle. Like, there's certain restaurants that make me feel good. I like the environment. They're super nice. The food may be hit or miss, but I'll continue to go back because of the way that restaurant makes me feel being there.
In talking to young chefs today, there are a lot of young chefs in St. Louis. What would you say to them? Do you think that they have to come to a world capital, a culinary capital, be it New York or Chicago or Paris?
I don't think you have to, but I would highly recommend it because it's just too incestual and like it just recycles. Like, you can't, if you work at all the nice restaurants in St. Louis, like you're going to see kind of the same techniques, the same style. You're cooking for the same market. You're not going to be as well-rounded as if you worked in Chicago for a couple years or you came to New York for 5 years and then go back to your hometown and start working again.
You bring a whole new toolkit.
You bring a whole new toolkit. And there's always the thing that Chef Daniel always talks about. It's your backpack and traveling with your backpack, and you're putting your techniques and everything you learned and your experiences in your backpack. And you always have that backpack on, and no one can take anything out of it.
Right.
But you're responsible for putting things in it.
Are the kitchens in New York different from the kitchens in Chicago? Or?
Oh, yeah.
How so?
There are more people in them. Space is tight. I just feel like there's this energy in kitchens in New York City that you don't find elsewhere.
Not even in Chicago or San Francisco?
I mean, there are definitely certain restaurants in Chicago, yes, but definitely not as many. And I haven't been in too many. I've been in a few restaurants in Chicago, but yeah.
What about Europe versus New York?
Europe, you have the Brigade Kitchen. We just did an event in Zurich, and we're at the Borlaug Hotel doing an event, and that's where Daniel first started cooking, so it was kind of cool to go back there, and some of the chefs that he worked for and the porters still remembered him from when he was, you know, a young cook at that place. But they're just different, and a lot of those places are, you know, contracted workers or apprentice, and they stick around for a long time, and It's just a big mix. And, I mean, obviously, if you go to the three Michelin star restaurants, they work very hard, and they're there in the morning. You go in at 7, 8 in the morning. Maybe you get an hour break, depending on your mise en place, and then you come back and you work service, and you work till it's closed, and you do that maybe four days a week sometimes if you work that schedule, 5 days a week, but it's hard.
It is hard.
I think that's a dying thing, though. I think that style of cooking won't continue into the future. I don't think so.
Where do you think the new inspirations are going to come from? I mean, a long time it was Copenhagen.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's been this dalliance with Peru. Is there a new place out there where all the chefs are going to discover?
I don't know. I mean, that's so hard to say. I mean, South America is blowing up. Mexico is definitely, you know, high on that list. But a lot of it, I think, has to do with what people like Renee was doing at Noma, that philosophy of sense of place. And like Noma, you can't recreate that anywhere else. And the ingredients that they use there is very special to that region. I think more restaurants need to do that same kind of philosophy, is search within and see what you have around you, and let those ingredients speak for themselves.
Mm. Well, any last words of wisdom for our listeners out there about A, what to eat when they come to 11 Madison, or for a young chef, what's a golden rule?
Come to 11 Madison, please. our menu format did just change, so it's really cool, and you do have some choices. It's a little bit shorter menu.
Tell us about that.
So instead of doing, before we were doing like 12, 14 course menu, and your only choice was, do you want your foie gras hot or cold? And would you like veal or duck? And those that was it. And now the format is more set up like an a la carte restaurant. I mean, it's prefix, tips included. But there's things for the table. There's a lot of communal things, table side service. But you get like choices. So your appetizer, you could choose, you know, a beet salad, foie gras, or hamachi, for example. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with entrees. There's just more choices to set up like an a la carte. And mm-hmm. the conversation between the server and the guest is more of a dialogue, you know.
Reason why they changed?
I think that people don't want to sit down for 4 or 5 hours and have this huge meal of 14 courses. And it's not natural to eat that much food.
Yeah.
And you go and you have 14 courses. How many of those do you remember? It's just not worth it. It's better to focus on 7 courses where you can, and I think that the guest is going to remember more.
Why do you think we got to that stage? I mean, even at the French Laundry, it went into the 20s. You know,
yes.
How did that happen?
I think it's just evolution. It's just the way that it happened. I think, you know, the French Laundry, you know, that's one of the greatest restaurants in the country. And I think you look up to that, and you know, you want to beat that, and you want to keep going.
So everybody just
yourself,
one more.
And they think more is better, you know?
And yeah. And they were just bites. I mean, they were super long.
Yes.
Okay, so to end, I can't believe it's gone that fast. What's a golden rule that you live by that you can share with your fellow chefs?
I think young chefs, they need to be smart on where they work. Pick a place that has high standards that's going to push you. And stick with it, even when it gets hard. Like push yourself, set goals, and meet those goals. You know, set realistic ones. And sometimes it gets rough, but you stick with it, and in the end, you're going to be a stronger person and a stronger chef.
I have one more question. You mentioned a chef earlier who is a mentor to you. How many mentors have you had in your life, and how important are they?
I'd say probably 2 chefs that I would consider mentors of mine, Anu Chariat, Daniel Hume, and I've learned the most from them. Other than that, people that inspire me is usually, you know, my family and the people that have supported me.
That's great. Well, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you
and
so much, Dorothy.
Thanks,
it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for coming today. And I'd like to do a shout out to our producers, Robin Cohen and Jack Inslee, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.